This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Jay. Thanks, friend. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now on with our episode.
It's a lot of soldier, learning how to be a soldier.
These women have to perform so that USA Gymnastics brings in sponsorships, so that US Olympic Committee can be proud of them and trot them out every 4 years for all of us to watch, so that NBC viewers can, you know, it's a money machine. And at the heart of it are teenage girls and their bodies. It seems like an arrangement that's bound to create abuse.
Aaron Lee Carr's latest documentary, At the Heart of Gold, asks who besides Larry Nassar was responsible for permitting a culture of abuse to flourish in American gymnastics. And the answers may not be satisfying. And Wondery's investigation into the disappearance of Susan Cox Powell, Cold, may have an answer as to what became of Susan when she disappeared in 2009, but that may not be satisfying. Is well-crafted testimonial narrative the only justice available sometimes? That grim pronouncement and many others on The Blotter Presents, episode 95. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. Better than pretty good is my guest, Stephanie Early Green. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Before we begin our discussion today, a content warning for the entire episode. We are discussing cases of sexual assault and of domestic violence. Some of the clips do get somewhat explicit. Whatever your trigger point, please take care of yourselves. And if you need to skip this episode, please do. Okay, into our most wanted section. Aaron Lee's documentary, At the Heart of Gold, has not aired yet. I believe it premieres this Friday, May 3rd, on HBO. We did have a screener. Here's the case file from HBO's landing page for the film. For more than two decades, Dr. Larry Nassar was the osteopathic physician for the U.S. Women's Olympic Gymnastics team, as well as a physician at Michigan State University. During that time, he sexually abused hundreds of female athletes. Aaron Lee Carr's documentary, At the Heart of Gold, Inside the USA Gymnastics Scandal, reveals a dangerous system that prioritized winning over everything else, including protecting young female athletes. Through interviews with dozens of survivors, as well as coaches, lawyers, and journalists, the film exposes an environment in which young women spent their youth competing for victory on a world stage, juxtaposed against a culture where abuse was hidden and lives were forever damaged. Oh, boy. Okay. This is a tough hour and a half that I think is very good. I'm a big fan of Aaron Lee Carr's work. She made Same. Mommy Dead and Dearest.
Which we also talked about.
Yes, which we also talked about. She made a film that I think no one ever talks about when they're talking about her, about the cannibal cop case in New York City that I thought was very well done. And I believe her next project, which is coming out this summer, is about the texting suicide case.
Michelle, girl in Massachusetts, Michelle Carter.
Yes, that sounds right. I know I've talked about that case via the Lifetime movie on this podcast. I'm interested to see what the non-scripted version looks like. This was very good. An hour and a half didn't seem long. It felt long, given the subject matter. Stephanie, how did you feel about it generally, like the length and the structure, the build of it? How did you feel about it?
Well, it was the length was appropriate. It was very well built. It was very well structured. It built, it snowballed up to a certain point where by the end of it, it's a real sock in the gut, because it's the victim impact statements at Larry Nassar's trial.
Yes.
Which was, I think, a really appropriate but very tough to watch culmination of all the testimonials of his abuse and all the ways that the system failed these athletes. So I have no complaints about the structure, the length. They didn't try to do anything cutesy or cheesy or like clever. It just was very straightforward. And I think that's what you have to do when you're telling this kind of story. And I appreciated how much time they spent with the actual victims / survivors of Larry Nassar, rather than focusing so much on him or the police investigation. It was more just about, I mean, they talked about that, but it was more about how this impacted individual lives, which I think is important.
I agree. I think Carr has made some comments to reporters about, or in reviews, about the fact that this film is really, you know, about and for the survivors. And compared with Believed, which was the podcast that you and I talked about the same case, Nassar, you know, he has to be at the center of it, but there's only so much of him that I personally can take.
Yeah, me too.
And I almost felt like this was two documentaries. The first half was talking about Bella Caroli and his, you know, ranch, and basically this like batch processing of these athletes, these gymnasts. And then John Gettert, who also was a big enabler of Nassar at his gym. And then the second documentary was the second half, and that was the victim impact statements and the sentencing hearings and the absolutely fantastic, in style and substance, Judge Aquilina.
Love her.
We have there's a photo in the visual aids. You can find those on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter, of her just dropping this letter that Nassar sent the court like it was coded in shit, which basically it was. Just him being self-pitying, like, I don't know how much more of these impact statements I can take. Like, good.
Like, yeah.
Choke
that's
on
the
them.
Point, dude. Yeah.
And then she just drops it and makes this face. And yeah, she's amazing. But it felt like two documentaries, but I think that worked well, because any more of any of it, and I think that the audience just starts to shut down.
Glaze over, yeah.
Yeah.
Protectively.
Yeah, absolutely. I did kind of want a lengthier indictment of Caroli and of the shift generally in Olympic gymnastics, at least, from, you know, it being a woman's sport to it being a girl's sport. But I think maybe if she had done that, I would have been like, no, that's too much. We get it. So well built, generally. I also liked that there wasn't a whole lot of Nassar, of his interrogation. But there was, you do see a lot of footage of him doing what I guess are informational videos.
Yeah. I don't know who the audience for those videos is, like other osteopaths or... I couldn't figure that out. Trainers?
I couldn't either, or if anyone saw them. But that was a very effective way to underline that his sort of, you know, there's something about the Midwestern accent that projects a guilelessness that is...
We talked about that last time.
Yeah, that is like not always present. But, certainly he... I don't know if he used that, but in this environment, his relative warmth and caring was like the only exemplar of this that the athletes had. And that just allowed him to take full advantage of that, as we discussed before. You pulled a clip pertinent to that. Shall we have a listen to that?
Yep.
One of the main themes about the Caroli philosophy is athletic Darwinism. There are so many kids out there. The U.S. is so deep now that if you can't hold up physically or if you can't handle it mentally, well, there's somebody dying to get in here who will pay the price. So they knew they could push these kids hard, hard, hard.
This kind of like brutal, do a lot of numbers, as many numbers as possible till you do it. Doesn't matter if you're falling flat on your back 5, 10, 15, 20 times. Doesn't matter if you're injured. You better not speak up was the whole mentality in the environment. You better not, or else we're going to take your Olympic dream away.
You're beat up. You have coaches screaming at you, bullying into doing stuff that you're not either ready to do or you're too tired to do, so you're put in dangerous situations. And Nasser was the guy, he was the positive guy. He's the guy who snuck him food, gave him candy, let him borrow a cell phone. I mean, you talk to all these women who were on the national team who were abused by him, they said, you know, he was our friend. If Larry's doing this, it must be okay because he's our friend. He's like the one guy we trusted.
Yeah, that's pretty much the whole case in a nutshell. Although they do get into also the fact that just as a trainer, he sucked. Like, never mind that this setup was allowing him to abuse hundreds of athletes, but that he also wasn't giving correct treatment.
Well, there were two sides to that, I thought. I mean, some of the girls said in retrospect, well, gee, why am I not getting better? Or why was I not getting better? You know, why did I keep having to go back to have the same treatment 2-3 times a week when it wasn't actually giving me results? But then other people they interviewed said, well, he was the only one who could fix me. And I don't know if that was just like a placebo effect where they felt like they were being fixed by him, or if he actually once in a while did actually do some medical good for these people on top of abusing them. So I wasn't sure about that, actually.
Yeah, there were a couple of that said, you know, I hated the treatments, but they seemed to work. But I was thinking of the one gymnast who was continuing to tumble on like a splintered leg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they show this X-ray and you're like, oh, that's nice. So on top of being a monster, you're also incompetent.
Yeah.
Cool.
Right. But he didn't order an X-ray when she's complaining about this pain in her leg. He's like, no, I'll just manipulate your private parts. You know, it's crazy.
Oh, God. Yeah. And then they also talk about, I don't think I remembered, or maybe I blocked it out, just how many times the parents were in the room for this. And I had also forgotten the failure to use gloves. Oh, God, this guy. Ugh.
Disgusting.
But yeah, his grooming in that way to sort of announce what he's going to do as though it's totally normal did normalize it. And then since the parents had been present and nobody had said anything about it being untoward, then the parents wouldn't accompany them the next time. And then it would be normal for them to have a treatment in his basement.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a clip about that.
Every appointment, he would have his hands all over me, adjusting me, massaging my back. And what some people might not understand, that this is a really big part of gymnastics that he took advantage of, that we're used to having adults spotting us, helping us stretch. We're used to having adults touch us. But Larry took it a step further. He explained to my mom, I'm going to put my hands near a very private place on your daughter. He didn't ask. He just said that that's what he was going to do.
Yeah. I'm glad that you asked for that clip because I had also marked that scene because we talked about this before, I think. And you had brought in an experience of yours as a kid that, you know, as a kid who's also an athlete, adults are all over you.
Yeah. I don't remember that, but it's true.
Yeah. I mean, and there's definitely sort of footage to support that. That's just footage of like training and practice and adults helping the gymnasts stretching and like leaning on them to get them to a like wider than 180 split.
Yeah.
Like the full weight of a grown up man. So this was not Like, to be touched and sort of corrected physically all the time was not unusual
right.
for them. So he was able to take advantage of that also. There is in this documentary, like, sometimes this testimony from the talking head interviews is accompanied by the, like, osteopath, conference video that we were talking about before. And it's him sort of demonstrating, I'm not exactly sure what he's demonstrating. He's having gymnasts do certain moves in a, what looks like a medical examining room, and their faces are blurred out, which, sure, but it is a bit unsettling that there is his face as he's basically selling his program, and then they are unidentifiable. And there's just something about that was, I don't think it was a wrong choice by the filmmaker. I'm just saying it was, you know, bracing.
Off-putting, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
So, yeah, you had another clip about his methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to introduce that?
This is like a slow build of factors that allowed him to get away with this, you know. And he, like any good predator does, he worked, he built both the victim's trust and the parent's trust. And once he had done that, he was able to get away with seemingly outrageous levels of abuse that he dismissed as medical treatments, including vaginal adjustments. I have that in quotes on my notes with the word of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ underlined like 4 times, because, you know, a vaginal adjustment, really, for ankle pain. And, you know, when you say it out loud, you're like, how the hell was this man allowed to get away with this? Who could believe that that was possibly a treatment? But I mean, when you think about all the factors going into bolstering his authority and how desperate these girls were to feel some relief from, you know, pain that they were experiencing because of overtraining and abuse they were experiencing from verbal abuse from their other coaches, and the fact that the parents were eager to see their kids not be in pain and the parents were there within the room. I mean, there are all these reasons that he was able to get away with it. But when you hear it explained in retrospect, it's very upsetting and seems crazy. So that's why I called for that clip.
Yeah. Before I play the clip, I will also say, I think this is also in the visual aids, but someone makes reference to the fact that the Curly Ranch actually was kind of this like small timey operation. Like a lot of it was kind of amateurish in who was hired, and the fact that I think Nasser flourished from his like employer's point of view, because he was able to tell them, like, yes, I can get this athlete back out on the floor.
Yep.
But they show a picture of his training room at Twistars, and it's like a hoard. It's just like a massage table plunked down in a closet. And it just looks, it's so dingy. There's not even a door. And it's like, if this is what you're accustomed to, is this kind of bogue environment most of the time, you might not question something that sounds, I don't know, as my uncle would say, storefront churchy. Like, it just sounds like worship. But then it's like, well, that's so crazy that maybe it works.
Right.
Anyway.
Maybe I'm the uninformed one. You know, he's the doctor. Yeah, it must be right.
Yeah. He's in the, you know, Michigan Gymnastics Hall of Fame, and I'm just some guy. So maybe it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're trying to make the Olympic team and you're really desperate to not have ankle pain, you might choose to believe any felonious snake oil explanation.
Yeah. And anyway, you're a child with no sexual experience, probably. So you don't know, you know?
Yeah. And if your parents are like, well, you know, if that's what he says, like if all the grown-ups around you sign off on it. Anyway, here's the clip. I believe actually this woman was a dancer and not a gymnast, but that's just another reminder of the breadth of his swath of destruction. Here's clip four.
He told me that I would probably be uncomfortable and kind of explained that in the vagina, there's a trigger point or pressure point that would release to help him work on my ankle to be less painful.
I mean, if he says it with authority.
Yeah. A trigger point in the vagina that would help release pain in the ankle. I mean, the boldness of this man. And he got away with it.
Yeah.
For a really long time.
Yeah. He really did. There is a moment. I'm about to play a clip. I'm not sure how you pronounce this survivor's name. I think it's Trinea Gonchar.
I think it's Trine, but I don't. Trine is the first name, but I don't know about the last name.
Okay, well, let's go with Trine.
Yeah.
The film shows most of her impact statement, and is that the one where he starts sobbing?
I think so, because she was defending him up until the very end.
Yeah.
So I think he realized, like, he'd lost even his most loyal, you know, supporters / victims.
Exactly. And as the film goes on, she's in talking head interviews, and she's not, like, cheery, but she's relatively sanguine, I guess, is the word, about not having really thought much about it, not really thought too deeply on it, that you're always sort of in pain and having treatments for something or other. And as the film goes on and as the interviews proceed, she starts to seem more hesitant and somber. And then at around the hour mark, she starts talking about everything kind of becoming clear and the guilt that she feels. And then we also hear from the filmmaker. Here's clip five.
I started to have a heavy guilt about other people that had come to me when I was younger and saying, you know, I'm confused. Something happened to me, but, you know, do you know anything about this? And I'm like, oh, yeah, it happens to me all the time. It does it to me all the time. You're good. You don't have to worry. It's not weird. You're not the only one. He does it to me all the time. So you're good. And then thinking, like, oh, my God, like, did I just silence these people? Like, did I stop them from stopping him? I did.
That's because you didn't know what it was.
But I still did.
I started crying at that point, and I'm actually a little emotional still hearing it, I think, for the fourth time, because I cut this clip and everything. He abused her in this way also. That she has to carry the guilt for what this fucking monster did. It's really quite an amazing piece of testimony, that interview. It's wretched to watch. She's miserable and it's so sad, but it's also so powerful. So well done, everyone, except Nasser. You're horrible. You should rot.
Yeah. The clip that got me sobbing, which I didn't call for you to clip, but we talked about this when we discussed Believed, but the woman Kyle, whose parents were friends with the Nassers, her victim impact statement when she talked about, you know, how this had destroyed her family and how she worked to try to repair her relationship with her father before he committed suicide a couple years ago was like so wrenching. And I was really, I mean, my pregnant ass over here was just sobbing for like the last however many 10 minutes of the film because of that. I mean, this guy really, when you talk about sexual assault destroying lives, it has this ripple effect where it really tears apart not just the victim but their family, and there's all this guilt that is diffuse, you know, and settles on everyone, even when it's not earned. It was really rough.
Yeah. I mean, you could hear at that point in her testimony, someone in the courtroom is like, says, oof.
Yeah.
Like, and weeping. It's like, oh, and it really is like, just sit here and listen to what you did.
Yeah.
To not just directly, but indirectly. Ugh. The last clip is more rage making than sad. They did talk to one of Nassar's attorneys. And if this bit was only included to sort of focus us on him being shitty and on defense attorneys being shitty, like, he, you know, this is still America and he has the right, et cetera, and so on. But that she would say this while the red light is on and that Aaron Lee Carr would snarkily leave it in and just be like, am I right, people?
Yeah.
Here's clip six.
I believe law enforcement said there were 37,000 or more than 37,000 images. It sounds like a high volume to people who are not familiar with these cases, but in all honesty, it's not a high volume.
Oh, so...
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Okay, cool.
It's only 37,000 child porn images. It's nothing.
Yes, on Nassar's computer. Yeah, like, it's not like it was 100,000. Like, oh, yeah, good point, Shannon. And then she goes on to say that she was getting death threats. Like, well...
Yeah.
That's the gig. It's like the worst kept secret on earth in terms of being a defense attorney. Like, I understand that he has the right to counsel and to a defense, but don't act like there's really a defense.
No.
Why would you say that? Why would you just be like, well, you know, some of these pervs have like a million images.
And, you know, she's not defending him anymore in court. She could have just said, yeah, that I wasn't pleased for his case when we heard that. She could have spun that in a number of ways or just been honest, like, yeah, that wasn't great news. Like, defense attorneys are allowed to say that, you know, without admitting that without smearing their client's name further. But they could just be like, yeah, I wasn't thrilled when I heard he had 37,000 child porn images on his computer, you know. She didn't have to say that.
Ugh. Yeah, and you know, there are ways to sort of let it be known that while this job was difficult and unsavory, you did it to the best of your ability, and with that said, there is nothing that you can do to reframe Larry Nassar as anything but what he is.
Yeah.
And yet they left it in. Which my notes were like, I cannot believe they left this in. And like, why would you do that except to undercut her? And then I think that's why. To just give us a little break to despise someone for some other ancillary reason.
Sure.
Ugh. Anyway, this is, I would say, in the Dear Zachary category of... It's a, you know, it's quite a document, and it is important to hear this testimony, and it is not easy, and you will probably cry, but it's very well done.
It was.
Yeah. Anything else on this before we move on to a bleak in a different way property?
No.
All right. This, once again, is called At the Heart of Gold. It airs Friday, May 3rd on HBO. Check your local listings. And now... we are contemplating another podcast from Wondery. It is called Merely Cold. Little hard to believe that nobody had taken that title, especially at Wondery. They really have a way of getting these like very broad, punchy titles. This began dropping episodes, I believe, in November of last year. Here's the case file from the Wondery landing page. Susan Pell disappeared from her home in December of 2009. Her body has never been found. The man suspected of killing her was never arrested or charged. This begins the complete story of the search for Susan. My portentous tone in reading that is advised. Mm. So We have a bunch of clips. I will also add that Investigation Discovery did a limited, like a two-night event on this case at around the same time last year, possibly linked to this in some way. And Oxygen now has a limited series that begins Saturday, May 4th. I do have screeners of that, but did not watch them. We thought that Wondery was the best equipped to address this story without being too pulpy or hasty. Have you listened to the whole thing?
So I got to episode 10 when they started going more in depth about the little boys, and then I had to, for self-care reasons, stop listening. And I can't remember the last time I've done that with a podcast. I'm pretty like thick-skinned in terms of like true crime content usually, but something about this case, I have two kids who are around the same age as those kids were when they were murdered by their father, and I just couldn't deal with it, so I had to stop listening. I'm also pregnant, as I mentioned, so that does not help at all in terms of my emotional resilience. So, yeah, I made it through episode 10.
That may not be just you. I mean, certainly when, like, I can't even look at an image of Susan Smith recoiling. There are just certain cases that, it just, like, they show the family photo and you're like, I'm not gonna make it. there's gonna be weeping. But you did mention one of the outcomes of this case, and it's something that the podcast and the host Dave Colley is his name. I think that's right. Foregrounds like pretty soon. It's in like the first 10 minutes of the first episode. I do have a clip.
It's almost a foregone conclusion that Josh killed his wife, Susan, in December of 2009. He told police he had taken their two boys out for a desert camping trip in a blizzard after midnight. When they returned the next afternoon, Susan was nowhere to be found. Her body has never been located. Nearly 2 years later, as police closed in, Josh killed himself and his sons. This podcast is the result of an investigation spanning more than 3 years and five Western states. It's involved the review of tens of thousands of pages of police reports, warrants, emails, social worker notes, psychological evaluations, personal journals, and more. Everything you're going to hear has been carefully sourced.
I wanted to ask you what you thought of the decision to put that outcome right up top.
I think it's fine because this case happened in what, like, he killed them 2010, something like
that? Yeah, I think 2011, but yeah, not long
after. She went missing in 2009, and then it was a couple of years after that. So it's not like, you know, it's not like a spoiler. We all live in the world, and this case got a lot of attention at the time. So I'm fine with it, actually. And it kind of allows the podcast to get into the foreshadowing more effectively, to be honest, because you know what's coming. And also it allowed me to protect I already knew this case, but let's say I didn't. It allows you to protect yourself and stop listening when you know it's going to get too rough. So,
right. I thought it was fine also. It's a little unusual for this like staple of podcasts. I feel like often they count on their storytelling to create reluctance to Google and to just sort of trust the story that you're going to get into it. On the other hand, we do all live in the world. There is a lot of other material out about her in the true crime space that I mentioned before. And I thought it was, probably the right call to just say, this is what we know happened and this is what we're pretty sure happened, and then backtrack through all the warning signs, which were, you know, myriad. This is, you know, obviously not victim blaming, but with the benefit of childhood hindsight, her husband Josh, like, this is someone who was killing pets and threatened his mom with a knife when he was 13. Mm-hmm. But we do go through his childhood and also his parents' marriage at some length. How did you feel about the like pacing and the length of episodes in the early going?
So I have mixed feelings. Some of the episodes were I thought the material they included was interesting and helpful. Like the stuff about Josh's family, I think actually does go a long way to explaining why he was such a weirdo, and also
his father in particular.
The dynamics with his creep.
Ugh.
I can't even have like utter creepy snake of a father who was you know, basically sexually stalking his daughter-in-law for the entirety of their relationship. So that was all useful. However, a really clear example of when this, I felt like the podcast was overstuffed and could have done with a lot of editing, was in episode 4 when they introduced Ellis Maxwell, who is the investigating police officer. Mm-hmm. He's a detective who was involved in this case. They spent a good, like, I don't know, I fast forwarded over a lot of it, but I want to say like 10 minutes talking about Maxwell's background. And first he was at this police department, then he had a fight with his boss and he ended up at this police department. Like, it does not matter. It is not relevant to this case. Just say who he is, say how long maybe he had been working on this particular team, and get into the story of the Susan Powell and forget like Ellis Maxwell's favorite flavor of coffee, you know? And
it's hazelnut. Just kidding. I haven't got to episode 4 yet.
Yeah.
I'll be like, it's French vanilla. Weren't you listening?
No, I wasn't. And I don't know if it's just because this is a 21 episode series and the host felt like, well, you know, people want every detail of this case. I'm just going to stuff it as full as I can or what. But like that episode in particular, I was like, ugh. And then there was a whole episode where they talk about searching mines, abandoned mines for her remains, which is interesting, but I think I personally could have done with a lot less detail on that. You might disagree.
I haven't gotten as far into it as you.
Okay.
But it's like each episode is an hour and change.
And there's 21.
Yeah. And there's like the first couple of episodes, or the first one really felt both like too leisurely and too rushed.
Yeah.
There was that sense, I should come up with a name for this. I guess it's the like, I did this research and goddammit, it's going in principle.
Yep.
You often see this in like prestige crime nonfiction where it's like, look, I drove to east of nowhere, Iowa, to go into the mildewy archives of this small town, and I found one fact that's not even that relevant, but I drove here, so it's going in.
Yeah, exactly.
That felt a little bit when it came to like we're getting sort of a week by week accounting of the status of Josh's parents' marriage. That's like, not that this isn't relevant, because I think it is, but I think maybe this should have been boiled down.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the fact that this, like everyone involved in this case, documented their lives across media to this like insane, like incomprehensible degree for people who are not 13-year-old girls. Like audio diaries, actual journals, journals that Josh would make that he would have Susan scan, including like all of his gas station receipts and all of this. And it's like, this is really a, you know, treasure trove of material, particularly for a podcast storyteller.
Yeah. I'm sure it was hard to narrow it down, but you have to, you know?
Yeah.
Have you noticed at the beginning of each episode, he says, it was hard to fit everything into the podcast. If you want extra material, go to this website. I'm like, dude,
what is left?
We're good.
It's like, here's a leaf rubbing that one of the kids did for the, yeah. You have a clip from episode 2 from Josh's audio one of his audio diaries. Would mm-hmm. you like to introduce that?
Yeah, this, I just pulled it to because it gives a good picture of his creepy voice and kind of Michael Jackson-esque affect. Something about it reminded me seriously of Michael Jackson, which is not great, right? So that's why I pulled it.
Okay, here we go. Clip 8.
I just wanted to say, to remind myself for the future, that I feel like I have been incredibly blessed because of my righteousness, because of my willingness to pay my tithing.
Yeah, there is this like, boo-boo kitty tone that he adopts, that Michael Jackson, that was like absolutely an affectation, and his regular, like just around people he knew voice was apparently very different.
Yep.
But yeah, he, there's just something so self-satisfied about both his audio recordings and his father's.
Oh God, his father.
Even when his father is not aware that he's still recording himself. Okay. He was being like the things that Steve is the dad's name, right?
Yeah.
That Steve was doing to Susan are now felonies in many states, like putting a mirror under the bathroom door when she was in there. Ugh. He, I believe, like collected her sanitary products, not used, but still don't. I mean, I assume they weren't used. okay, good.
Something I don't know. I mean, I don't put anything past this guy.
I don't either. He, like, whatever, they like videotaped everything compulsively and were much more interested in like the camera itself, I think, and the technology than necessarily the people that they were recording, unless they were using it for self interested purposes. I'm not even going to complete that thought. Here we'll be hearing Steve, who thought he turned off the camcorder when he put it in his bag but did not. He is driving Susan to her parents' house and has decided to declare his love for her, as you'll hear in clip 9. Just a reminder, this is her father-in-law, and he is 30 years older than she is, and he is a disgusting pig. Here's clip 9.
I'm probably wrong, but I've really fallen in love with you. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, for the last year and a half, you're about the only thing I can think about. I don't know where it began. It probably began when you were living with me and would come into my office and, you know, let me feel your legs smooth, relaxed, whatever. And then it just went from one thing to another. And, you know, that experience on the couch, on your couch in Yakima 6 months ago was just, I mean, I know that, I mean, it was a massage, right? But you know, just being with you for 2 hours and holding you, and
that long silence spoke volumes.
Yes. Yes, it did.
So gross.
I mean, this clip almost, like, I think it sort of highlights how awkward he is and how clueless he is, and just like not, he's just not right. He's not right. But the discomfort of it is sort of in the foreground here, and this is leaving aside that, like, I mean, this was a, you know, deadbeat who played his kids off of each other and their mom and didn't pay child support, and was bragging to his audio diary about how during this massage, which I'm sure she did not want, he got a hand inside her sleeve and was inches from her breast, and like, this guy is
disgusting.
Is wrong.
Yeah.
And So, but this is extremely uncomfortable to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, and yet he persisted, kind of. Like, sorry to use that phrase, but it's just so telling that, like, this is how, like, predators like this can kind of continue, because it's really either the object of their predation is, as Susan was, very naive / unwilling to sort of make a scene about it or draw a line about it.
Because I think she was, yeah, sorry to interrupt you. She was like 21 years old, Mormon.
Yeah.
Super sheltered. Hadn't done a lot of dating, got married to this dude, and then is stuck in this terrible family and had two kids and didn't feel like, well, at this point, she's probably like over 21. I think she's 21 when they got married. Didn't feel like she had options to leave because of social, cultural, religious pressure, and also because where else was she going to go, you know?
Well, and also because I think if you're raised in a family that does not act like creepers, then you have no reason to assume that your father-in-law would behave this way or develop these feelings for you,
yeah,
or say anything about them if he did.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, again, not blaming her at all. But the fact that he can make this announcement, develop these feelings, make this announcement, accidentally tape himself, keep the recording. Like, wouldn't you throw that in a ravine? And then the family just kind of continues because I think that's a frequent, normal response, that it's just like, we can't deal with this, so we won't.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking in light of everything else. Mm-hmm. You had another clip sort of related to this. Did you want to talk about clip 10?
Well, actually, the reason I pulled this one, I don't know if we're going to talk about things we didn't like about the delivery of the podcast, but
you've been here before. You know.
Yeah. So I think frequently, especially with true crime podcasts with male hosts, I've noticed that they insert themselves into the center of the story. And I don't think this host does that, actually. And I appreciated that. However, what he does do is add this very distracting folksiness that feels out of place when he's telling such a grim story. And I'm not saying it all has to be doom and gloom, but vocal delivery does matter. And I felt like he was trying to lighten the mood often by inserting little like chuckles. And I have two clips as an example of this, clip 10 and clip 12. And both, I found it off-putting every time, and it would kind of take me out of the narration because I was like, God, don't do that. It's terrible. I don't know if you noticed it.
Yeah, I definitely noticed it before. Well, I'll play clip 10, but this was one that I had marked to be like, what are you doing, bro? And then you had called for it. So let me play clip 10.
The reality is, I don't think Susan is upset at me.
No. Susan was very upset. Her father-in-law had propositioned her, and her own husband didn't seem to care. She wanted nothing to do with Steve. When he came to visit Josh and Susan's apartment in October, she locked herself in the bedroom and refused to talk to him.
I mean, first of all, atta girl, but second of all, to your point, it was just like three reactions too many.
Yeah.
That he's like, no, like, okay, take that again. And
it
just
was
be
a lot.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think that he was trying to, you know, there is actually room for snark sometimes when you are responding to true crime and true crime properties. Thank God, or you and I would not be having this conversation
sure,
right now.
Yeah,
but
of course.
I also think that this isn't a matter of like inappropriate tone. He's just not as funny as he thinks he is.
Yeah.
And there's, he just overdid it. Shall I play clip 12? Because sure, that one was also a clunker.
Mm-hmm.
Detectives kept busy. They finally got a hold of the rental car. They didn't find any blood in it, but did see a brown Crayola crayon and a small silver handle, like from a toilet tank, in the trunk. They also spotted a quarter and a small tan-colored rock beneath the trunk carpet next to the spare tire. It was unlikely the crayon was a murder weapon, but the investigators took it anyway, and the rest as possible evidence.
Don't do that, dude. Yeah. Just say don't it was unlikely it. That, yeah, she was probably not killed by either a crayon or a quarter, but they took it. Like, there's, you can, yeah, someone at Wondery or KSL should have been like, do you want to just read that straight? See how it feels? And then we'll just drop it in later. But I agree that, as usual with Wondery product, like, even if it is not like groundbreaking or sort of, you know, it's the same ads you always hear. It's sort of the same rhythms and the same kind of interstitial music. Like, there's nothing all that innovative here, but it's extremely well put together and edited and paced. And generally speaking, this is a lot of information that he is synthesizing quite effectively. I'm going to keep listening to it. I just sort of ran out of time because,
yeah,
this is like the Nicholas Nickleby of crime podcasts.
Totally.
It is long.
How far did you get?
I got halfway through the third episode and then I had to stop. And I mostly stopped because I was like really marking a lot of clips. And I'm like, this podcast talking about it needs to not be as long as the entire run of Cold. But yeah, it's, I mean, despite sort of knowing the ending, I'm interested. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of it that I think are unique. I think this case is unique in the way, as I said before, that the sort of subjects were self-documenting the whole time. Like, there are things here that I don't think I have heard before or will have heard before, so I'm going to keep going with it.
Yeah.
So where, like, did you just jump over episode 10 and you're going to keep going, or you're out?
I don't know if I can, honestly, right now.
Fair.
Just the idea of those little kids being murdered is tough for me.
Yeah.
And the exact moment where I stopped in episode 10 actually was when they were talking about the kids were enrolled in like a YMCA summer camp after Susan had gone missing, and the little one was like so clingy and with every female caregiver, and I was just like, that's heartbreaking. I can't oh, listen God. To that. Like, it's too sad. It's just too sad, especially when you think about what happened to those kids later. It just got worse from there. The one person they thought they could trust murdered them and took away their mom. So I couldn't. Ugh. It was too much.
Yeah. Well, I will keep swimming upstream. And if it gets, you know, if there's like a sort of relatively lighthearted dog leg into, like, and then he robbed a bank, I'll let you know. But I mean, I don't know if I'll be able to get past that part, because there's just certain things that you're like, you know what? Yeah. I trust you and vaya con Dios, but I can't. You will have to go on alone.
Yes.
Listeners, I'm interested to hear. A few of you have asked if I was going to cover this on the podcast, and I'm interested to hear what about it made you want us to talk about it, and if any of the things that we've been talking about were like questions or concerns that you had about it, and how far you've been able to get. So definitely hit us on social media. That's Blotter Presents, both places. You did have a clip, Stephanie, from episode 4 where you were mentioning that it was a little long.
Yeah, we don't have to listen to it. It was more just about the, it was more of a content, not even a content note, just like a reflection on this case about how frustrating it is that Josh Powell was never arrested. And I think the podcast does a good job into going into why the police didn't arrest him. I mean, in retrospect, it seems so dumb. And it's really frustrating listening to their reasoning. But it does explain at least what happened and why he was allowed to evade them for a really long time. And then, you know, ultimately was never brought to justice. So,
right. Well, let's have a listen to it anyway, because I found it interesting that, you know, law enforcement was like, you know, in retrospect, would I do this differently? Yes. And in fact, because of this case, I do it differently now. So here's clip 11.
Looking back, Ellis regrets not writing a search warrant for the house and minivan that night.
Myself and the sergeant and my partner that was assisting at the time, you know, we discussed it. It's like, you know, can we get a search warrant right now? And the decision was no. You know, let's have him come back in the morning and do another interview and go from there.
It was a judgment call, arguably the wrong one. To this day, Ellis says he's not sure serving a warrant that night would have changed anything.
But it was a learning experience as well, because I'll tell you what, from that day forward, if I questioned if I needed a search warrant for a residence or a home, I wrote it and I submitted it. We'll let the judge make that decision.
Yeah, well,
that's good,
that's got to be tough. Yeah. Oh, I also wanted to mention that I have sort of an ongoing list of LDS related and adjacent crime properties that they tend to be, not that the crimes are good, obviously, but that for whatever reason, these properties tend to be really well done. Like there's almost never like a bad one about Warren Jeffs or about the that forgery case that turned into a bombing case from like 40 years ago. Oh. So I guess I would add this to that list, but having not gotten as far as you did, do they talk more about the church and sort of the role of faith in this marriage and these people's lives, or
well,
is it sort of...
No, they focus more on Josh and Steve's anti-Mormon bent.
Right. Okay.
And they talk about Susan's involvement with the LDS church in terms of like, that was her community. Mm. She took it seriously. She had the support from her ward group, but they don't go into like the theological underpinnings of why she might have stayed, you know, what theological factors were pushing her into a staying in that marriage or whatever. They don't do that. So no, it doesn't really go into the LDS aspect of it explicitly. It's more mentioned as just a factor in their lives and something they argued over.
Right. Which, you know, I don't think it's necessary to sort of like fetishize the church in that way. But I did get the sense from the first couple of three episodes that I was listening to that there were like ways that LDS church members are in their faith and their marriages and their personal relationships that might have borne a little more explaining to like an apostate retired Baptist like myself. So that was sort of interesting. And again, listeners, if that's something that you can shed light on or wanted more light shed on, let us know. All right, Stephanie, I'm sorry that this one was so unrelenting. Next time you come on, let's just do all like kitten and puppy thefts with happy endings and fun audio. In the meantime, where else can listeners find you and your work?
You can find me on my blog, StephanieEarlyGreen.com. That's about it right now.
Excellent. And I almost forgot to mention that I subbed in on Crime Writers On this week. So you can hear me, Kevin, and Toby doing a like Boys and Sarah Club talking about the Madeline McCann series, actually. That's Crime Writers On, wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. Also, this podcast. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, it's Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Jeb Lund. The newest Ted Bundy property from Joe Berlinger. We'll be talking about that next week. The week after that, I actually got called for jury duty. I don't think that'll last long, but it does mean that I'll be taking the week off. So keep an eye out for updates on the schedule. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, both places. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, it would be great if you could tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find it. My guest has been Stephanie Green, and she is on Twitter at Eteffi, E-T-E-F-F-I. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.